Grace and peace. Gracia y paz. Let us feel the Holy Spirit present with us. So, let me make this thing go. Hold on, I gotta make this go. I had almost everything set up. So some thoughts before we begin. Do not feel like you are drinking from a fire hose. This is a bird's eye view, okay, of something that normally I take a semester to do, to teach my students this methodology, right? And your questions and answers are really valuable. They're valuable to you. They're valuable to us as church. So note those, write them down, which is why I recommend the notebooks. And then bring them to our dialogue time, or if you're not coming to that, find somebody who's coming to dialogue time to bring your questions, or find me at other times, because we're making what's our product, everybody remember? Yeah. Right, but we're making insights. Yeah, insights, right? So you guys are making like very valuable things. And then the last thing is I write a lot and I do a lot of very different media things. So if there's lingering questions, then you can always go here. And this is my university's very fancy website for me. And it'll have like tons of stuff in it. And also how to contact me. So it's pretty easy, you know, expertfile.com, experts. And you guys also have it like on the website for the conference. Okay, so let's pick up from where we left off because we were a little short on time yesterday. And we're gonna kind of trace ourselves back a little bit to where we were meeting, right? This amazing human, J.B. Metz, and how influential his work has been on those of us that work in political theology. And the central thing, right, that Metz told us was that after the Second Vatican Council, it was clear that the privatizing of theology is the primary critical task of political theology, right? That we couldn't be looking inward, we had to be looking outward, right? And then, right, to actualize, which is why I keep coming back to you being theologians and to you making insights, right? You're making something, you're actualizing, right, the critical potential of faith in relation to society, right? How do these two things come together? And so another thing, right, that happened was the Second Vatican Council, the documents were kind of put away in a lot of affluent parts of the world that felt like, yeah, we really don't need this, right? We'll change the language and the mass and we'll do a few cosmetic things, but we're not going to really take this to heart. Whereas in other parts of the world, as I said, they really took them incredibly seriously. And so that's where we get to CELAM, which the Conference of Latin American Bishops of Bishops of Latin America and the Caribbean. And so they generated a series of documents that gave us today, you know, very important ways to do the work. And so they begin in Medellin, Colombia, and this is a really influential set of documents in 1968, right? So we're thinking, right, how long this has been and how little we have actualized this in the more northern parts of the world. Then they went to Puebla, and they had another groundbreaking meeting, and documents in Mexico in 1979. And then there was an in-between one that was not very fruitful. And then we get to Aparecida, which is in Brazil, and that's in 2007. And so as a body of church teaching, right, these documents laid out some of the priorities for responding to a world that needs us and that's going to guide us today. Right? So maybe you will not be surprised that the principal architect of the last of those documents, Aparecida, was Jorge Bergoglio, Pope Francisco, when he was Archbishop. And you're going to note that I refer to the Holy Father as Francisco because I think it's crucial for us to remember that his presence in Rome is most unusual and unprecedented because he's a Latin American and his prophetic vision for who we can be as church comes from doing this work as Jesus did, which was very, very attentive to the moment and accompanying the suffering in our world. So we've taken our first step, which is to ask why we want to do any of this. And as we answer it, not just today, but every day, we start to see ourselves as subjects, as agents, and as theologians with the task of embodying the church in the world and seeking insights for how to best do that. And this is our compromiso. And I hope that you can feel yourself called to be comprometida or comprometido. You know, in Spanish, every word is gendered, so apply it to yourself. But fully committed to that vision, right, that Isaiah shared, and then Jesus took up, and it's our job to help him transform the world, which we just sang about, right? So from here, we move to step number two, which is to accompany la realidad. And we're going to ask, what is a particular joy or sorrow of our present world that asks for your accompaniment? Where is that slice of reality that really needs you? Where can you recognize and understand the world in which we live? And this is using the words of the Second Vatican Council, its explanations, its longings, and its often dramatic characteristics. So what we want to do is put together Jesus' job description and today's news and see where that takes each of us, right? And the Spirit is speaking to the church in you. Okay? So we're going to do a little thing I call rewind and remind, and it's going to help us to review where we've been and then situate ourselves in our work for today. So first, we know that the theme I set out for us as a church in this conference is how to engage with the world that needs you, and that this is the task that we take on as church and as theologians. There are many ways, right, that this question could be answered outside of a religious tradition, but we're here to see how it is that we articulate and live it arising from our faith commitments and as embodied in us as church. Yesterday, we started out on this journey with our first step by asking ourselves why we wanted to do this work in the first place. And if we ask a how-to question, how to engage the world, this presupposes that we want to do it already, right? But that why that expresses our desire to learn how to do something well cannot be taken for granted. So if we don't ask, then we're in danger of burning out, of losing our motivation, or as we saw when we reviewed the really terrible statistics of those who've left the church, we can become one more number among those who walk away because they are done, and in walking away, they're telling us something really important. So asking that question of why do I care about this? Why am I here? Why does this matter to me? Why am I putting my time into engaging the world and helping the world? It's not a question that any of us can answer one time and for always, but it's really a question we have to ask ourselves every day. And this is the ongoing discernment that we need to do as people of faith. So I think this very first step of asking ourselves why we care is really captured beautifully by a famous Ignatian prayer that often gets attributed to Father Pedro Arrupe. And if you know it, I hope you do know it. If not, I hope you take it with you. We're going to read it. Nothing is more practical than finding God, than falling in love in a quite absolute, final way. What you are in love with, what seizes your imagination, will affect everything. It will decide what will get you out of bed in the morning, what you do with your evenings, how you spend your weekends, what you read, whom you know, what breaks your heart, and what amazes you with joy and gratitude. Fall in love. Stay in love, and it will decide everything. So there are some very basic things that we laid out yesterday to tease out our role of our faith in all this. The first is that the church is not an institution, but a way of being. Our why, right, has to arise from who we are, which is to say from the way we exist as people in the world. And as Catholic Christians, it is from here, from this community of faith, that we do the hard work of engaging the world. Second, we talked about how this church of ours is brought into being through a religious tradition, which means that this way that we exist in the world is passed along from generation to generation, embedded within a particular culture, and present in our daily lives. And this special time that your community here set aside for this conference is precisely a time of passing along our religious tradition as it engages the world. However, we also saw that there are correct ways to pass along our tradition and others that are counter to it. We saw that anything that excludes, judges, or compels is incoherent with a religious tradition that arises from the teachings and the life of Jesus and how his friends, our early church, understood it. And this is a second feature of doing the work of theology. It's not enough to pass along a religious tradition if that tradition loses its way. As the Jesuit Father Greg Boyle wrote recently, and this isn't in one of his books, it's in a note I got, we need to live as though the truth were true and put first things recognizably first. It was just in a note. And it was just so amazing, I had to bring it to you. So in his person, Jesus does something extraordinary. He takes on human weakness, human fears, and human joys too, all so that he can accompany us. And as St. Paul tells us in Jesus, God empties God's self completely of power, of safety, of divinity. And as we look at the scriptures, we see Jesus searching for his why of his own life, not once, but often, and finding that his answer deepens every time he encounters a new reality. So he lives in a way that distills truth for us and that sets clear priorities, as Father Greg said. What he models For us, it's the opposite of taking the easy way out by either assenting passively or walking away. With every new experience, Jesus enters ever more deeply into fragile humanity. And what he teaches us is that his road to God, our road to God, passes through each other. Now, we saw that those members of the church that really took to heart the call of the Second Vatican Council to engage the world did so by going back to the focus and priorities of the earliest Christians. And as they looked at the Gospels, they found the answer to how to deepen and nurture their why are we here. They discovered that what is required is what Jesus did and what his friends did. And so this is exactly what the Latin American church did and what in our time committed Christians like Martin Luther King Jr., Dorothy Day, Cesar Chavez, Saint Oscar Romero, and the Salvadoran Jesuits did so well. And this was to accompany la realidad. And I say accompany la realidad because it comes out of the theology of the groups that sometimes we call the Ibero-American peoples. As we saw with Selam, these are theologies having their origins in 22 different Latin American nations, mixed in with those of us in the Latin American diaspora, and often having origins in the Iberian Peninsula with Ignatius of Loyola, Teresa de Jesus, sometimes we call from Avila, St. John of the Cross, and more contemporary thinkers like the philosopher Javier de Zubiri, who greatly influences the Spanish Jesuits who end up in El Salvador, Ignacio Yacuría and John Sobrino. Along with St. Oscar Romero, they continued the work of the conference at Medellin. And as Romero put it, and I'm translating here, about the world of the poor, we say that it is the key for how to understand Christian faith. The role of the church and the political dimension of that faith and that ecclesial role. The poor are the ones who tell us what the world is and what the service of the church to the world is. The poor are the ones who tell us what is the polis, the city, and what it means for the church to really live in the world. Now, for Ibero-Americans, all this rich discernment of how it is that we exist in the world is also woven together with indigenous cosmologies and the beliefs and experiences of our forcibly displaced and exploited African ancestors. And in these parts of the world, meaning the region bounded by these borders the United States calls itself, all of this is then woven through the painful threads of being colonized by the United States or migrating here as most groups that preceded us and will follow us from other parts of the world. And it's in this context of marginality, of enslavement, colonization, and what may appear as incongruous hope that the idea of a God who accompanies us flourishes in the church. The often misunderstood images and rituals of Christ's passion in Latin America and the Philippines are precisely about mutual accompaniment. They're about relationship. As Jesus suffers through his last hours among us, in the most desolate aspect of being human, rejection, violence, death, the community walks with him, accompanies him, vows to not leave him alone. At the same time, the community knows that in every instance of pain and humiliation of their own lives, God is present, and God also walks with them. And we also see this in the music that enslaved peoples in North America created and continue to pass along in the tradition of African American spirituals. And there are many, but I'm gonna try one verse of one, with great apologies to my colleagues who are African American singers. I want Jesus to walk with me. I want Jesus to walk with me all along my pilgrim journey. Oh Lord, I want Jesus to walk with me. Now, this is what Saint Oscar Romero means when he says that the world of the poor is the key for how to understand Christian faith. It is the experience of the poor that brings us nearer to God, because they have nothing standing between them and God. And in their vulnerability, right, they see what the rest of us cannot see. So as Bishop Mark Seitz of El Paso tells us in his pastoral letter on migration, sorrow and mourning flee away. And if you haven't read it, please find it online and read it, especially in preparation for this coming election. He says, the church must illuminate the challenges of the moment with the light of the gospel, pointing out what reflects the kingdom of God and what does not. We can only do this if we walk with the most vulnerable. So accompaniment means being present to the other in a radical and truthful way. But what does la realidad mean? So we could translate it as reality, but especially in our day, reality is a very compromised word, right? I mean, think about it, right? Virtual reality, which is actually not real at all. Or reality television, which is also contrived and full of falsity, right? So la realidad refers to seeing what is actually happening around us. Not what we wish was happening, not what we hope will happen, not what we want to ignore is happening. La realidad requires us to be aware of our own biases and blinders, to check our privilege, to realize how we filter the world, and to take those filters off. And it is a concerted effort to honestly see what is going on. So for me, keeping the term in Spanish forces us to take a moment and be present to the task. So to accompany la realidad is very difficult work. If we do it honestly, it will hurt. And the shortest and maybe the most powerful verse in the Christian scriptures is Jesus wept. Does anyone remember where in scripture this happens?
Lazarus,
right? The death of Lazarus. So Jesus has been called to the bedside of a dying, very close friend. But when he gets there, Lazarus is already dead. The scripture tells us that the community is weeping. And Jesus joins them, accompanies them in their grief. And his weeping is understood by the community to be a sign of his deep love of Lazarus. To feel with and for others is to love. And because Jesus loves so deeply, the power of life flows through him. And the power of love overcomes the finality of death, renewing life. So when Jesus describes his calling using the words of Isaiah, what becomes clear is that his mission is to confront reality, especially in the situations where suffering is present. So for this second step on our journey, we want to become very good at accompanying, at walking with, being present, not avoiding, but seeking the other. And we want to do this in la realidad. Not in some safe place where our privilege might protect us, but in the messiness of life. So I asked you to think about a particular joy or sorrow of our present world that asks for your accompaniment. Where is that slice of reality that really needs you? In the words of Gaudium et Spes, where can you recognize and understand the world in which we live, its explanations, its longing, and its often dramatic characteristics? And then I said, we need to put together Jesus' job description and today's news and see where that takes us. So we now really want to listen to how the Spirit is speaking to the church in you. Just like we did yesterday, I want you to turn to a neighbor and I want you to share with each other the fruit of this discernment, of this bringing together. What in la realidad is calling out to you, asking that you accompany it, walk with it, perhaps weep with it? Where is your comprometida presence needed? And take some notes, because I wanted to share what you're going to create in insights with the rest of us. And we're going to take a few minutes to do this. There you go. Okay, so what we want to do now is really, right, feast on the banquet of the insights that you have made. So, can we start getting some of those dishes? What came up for you guys? What came up? What are some of the places where you are needed? Please.
We are needed. I think the three of us really feel felt, and we hear it echoed throughout the conference, which is really incredible. But those people who are outside the door knocking, so women, for us, really, it's a very much a reality. We have students in the LGBTQIA community. We have sisters and friends and brothers who are being shut out of our church, and it's getting very hard for us. I feel personally like it's my church, I'm not leaving. But we know so many who are so brokenhearted, so disenfranchised because they're being told that they're not welcome. And I don't know what to add to that. So that's, somebody brought up that, I'm not a cradle Catholic, but a lot of people are, that the cradle Catholics among us are kind of our own greatest weapon because they are, you know, sort of steeped in this tradition that belongs to them. And that I guess that's what's calling out to us. I don't know. I feel ineffective a lot of times about my presence and whether it can do anything because it feels like the structure is so ironclad and exclusive, especially to me as a woman, and especially to my students, my trans students. that it feels difficult to know how that's going to ever change. And if by staying, I'm contributing more to a system that is failing, then I am able to change it.
So three things just to give you right here, right now, but let us talk lots more. So my colleagues and I started a hashtag. It's hashtag mind too. The church is mind too. So that's number one. The church is mind too. I heard that in you. I heard that. I've been hearing that, right? The church is mind too. Second is the amazing website, Catholic Women Preach. 400 as of now, global women theologians, pastors, teachers, people at NGOs, people from the very top of some of the people that Pope Francis has just named, some of the women that he's just put in charge of stuff, all the way to, you know, being a campus minister and in between. So Catholic Women Preach. Every Sunday you're going to get an amazing homily, and you're going to get to know women that are writing amazing theology. And then the third is Discerning Deacons. And that's a movement of discernment from within the church for the restoration of the diaconate of women, which is already going on in the Amazonian region, as we know, and as Pope Francis has pointed out, extraordinary work is being done by women there to keep the faith and to serve the communities. And so Discerning Deacons is gonna have, again, a global group of women, but we also have, you know, bishops that are supporters, all kinds. And the whole idea is we're discerning from within the church that the church is being called to the restoration of the permanent diaconate of women. So we don't need to feel alone. The accompaniment of La Realidad is going on globally. And to look to those who are being kept outside is an extraordinary place to be. Others. Yes.
What came up for me was right away thinking about praying outside the Lilith Abortion Clinic in downtown Portland. But there are some faithful people that peacefully pray there. And what struck us in the midst of it is many of the women who show up there because they feel like they don't have a choice. They feel like they don't have a choice, which is kind of ironic. When there are more pregnancy help centers in this country than there are abortion clinics, and the church is there, the church is standing by to accompany, and the voices of the culture are so loud that accompaniment is not seen. And I was embarrassed and kind of anxious and afraid to go because there's been a lot of violence in Portland. And the whole time we were there, there was a peace. And sure, we got the finger and we prayed for those people. And sure, we got the cursing and we prayed for those people. And there were also the thumbs up and we prayed for those people. And I knew Jesus wanted me to be there. So I went, and his grace was enough. And it worked out. And so we carry on. And I would encourage people, because when people are outside simply praying, the percentage of abortions go way down at that location.
Well, another thing that brings down the percentage of abortions is when we have laws that support pregnant women, that support funding for prenatal care, preschool free preschool, all of these things. So there is a group of 30 prominent women theologians, Catholic theologians and leaders, and we've written and signed a letter trying to shift the conversation into what concretely will make life, full life, for mothers and their children possible. So you can look for that letter. It's the organization Faith in Public Life put that out, but it gives us a way to talk about the whole person and about all of life, as Pope Francis says, equally sacred, right? And he wants us to talk about poverty, and he wants us to talk about capital punishment, and he wants us to talk about nuclear armaments. So how do we coherently say life if we then pull back and do things that are against life, like taking away food stamps and cutting back on healthcare and things like that? So that's where the power of our tradition can come in, right? So so you're going to recall that I said that the Catholic tradition and modernity has had two truly major global moments of discerning why we want to be church and where the Spirit is leading us. And the first began over 60 years ago with the Second Vatican Council, and the second is today. And we're living in a change of epoch, as Pope Francisco has said, cambio de época. And if you recall, political theology takes on its form following Vatican II, when first Metz and then the Latin American Church followed the lead of the Council and opened the windows to the Church, as St. Pope John XXIII so famously asked the Church to do. For them then, and for us now, it is clear that the open window is revealing a reality that cannot be ignored. So theologian Elizabeth Johnson has pointed out three major historical shifts of the 19th and 20th centuries that affected the church, since they so deeply affected the world, the culture. And if the church was going to be present in the world, it would have to accompany these shifts. And I'm going to use her original shifts, but I'm going to expand on those in light of our questions. And what I find curious as we think about these shifts is that in many ways, they point much more to the kind of world and community of the ancient world than to the time in between. In other words, we could say that these global shifts created a kind of time portal. Okay, so I like science fiction too. Where we could once again experience the good news of the gospel in a way that was much closer to the way the first communities experienced it. So let's accompany that realidad and see what these shifts reveal. First, there was what Johnson calls the turn to the subject. And what does this mean? So you just have to think of the way feudal societies function to understand what this might mean. So we still see vestiges of this today in dictatorships and other authoritarian systems, but essentially with the rise of empires, monarchies, and nation states in human history, most human beings were not treated, nor did they view themselves as subjects of their own history. The hierarchy of power was such that whatever the Lord and Master said was the fate of all under them. Privilege accrued to a certain percentage of the population, and only those were granted any kind of autonomy or rights. In the United States context, even in a country supposedly founded on the idea of liberty, only white men who owned property were full persons. They were the only ones able to make choices for themselves. So the reality of the turn to the subject means seeing each human being as actually free and deserving of their dignity. It means a shift in the human community, but it's very much a problem that we're still grappling with globally. And it is this consciousness of personhood that begins to rise around the world and prompts the church into accompaniment with the very first document of what today we call Catholic social teaching, Rerum Novarum, of new things. And it was proclaimed in 1891 by Pope Leo XIII. What was that context like? Well, it was the Gilded Age. And enormous wealth was being created by the Industrial Revolution. And while most people were pushed into ever more precarious living and working conditions, the rich were getting richer through exploiting the working classes. Deaths in industrial accidents were commonplace, and child labor was accepted as a practice. And while feudalism had robbed most people of their personhood, the modern world's push toward what was termed progress was developing in really brutal ways, where only some people, persons, and others, cogs in the machinery of progress, are they? In accompanying the reality of the moment, the church advocated for the right to labor unions and collective bargaining, and took a stance that said human beings are never a means to an end, but an end in themselves. The document stressed the church's role in advocating for the poor and for an end to poverty by reforming working conditions and respecting universal human dignity. Now, the Latin American church would later develop two of these ideas much more fully. First, the clarity of the sacred scriptures in communicating God's preferential option for the poor. And the second, that all human beings have a God-given right to be the sujetos, the subjects of their own history. When we want to help the poor, it isn't sufficient to supply them with charity and to help to feed them, but rather we're called to search for the root causes of their poverty and create the conditions for them to transform the structures that keep them poor. And in this, the role of education is always identified as a primordial need. And I have argued in my own theological work that it's a basic human right. A second shift is the negativity of so much human experience. Accompanying la realidad, we can see the pain-filled roads of many of our fellow humans as they were and are traveling. Slavery, famines, and then two catastrophic world wars revealed that modern humans were capable of extraordinary cruelty. And the renewal that this brought about for the church was to recover Jesus' humanity and his teachings. Rather than only just focusing on Christ's redeeming act on the cross, this reality of suffering called the church to recover what Jesus had been teaching and doing. And with this shift, then we got a major research into the historical Jesus, which was a very needed updating of biblical scholarship, which had been done by our Protestant siblings, and a shift in focus from a church concerned with preserving itself as a reaction to the Protestant Reformation, to a church concerned with preserving the world and focused on social justice. Now, the third shift that Johnson identifies is the interconnectedness of the world. as communications and the possibility of global travel became more commonplace, the world shrunk. It was a new reality that the 1960s communications theorist Marshall McLuhan called the global village. And today, if we accompany la realidad, we will see that a true sense of our interconnectedness not only ties us to other human beings, but as Pope Francis keeps pointing out, to the planet itself. Although we have not wanted to learn the lesson, the COVID-19 pandemic was a stark reminder of our interdependence and of the illusory nature of what we call borders and even nations. This interconnectedness reveals to the church a radical equality. So in a way that could not be ignored, and that was addressed by Vatican II in 1965 in the document Nostra Aetate, in our age, addressing the relation of the church with non-Christian religions, the equality so clear in scriptures but conveniently forgotten by many is loudly proclaimed. So this is from Nostra Aetate. The church reproves as foreign to the mind of Christ any discrimination against people or harassment of them because of their race, color, condition of life, or religion. On the contrary, following in the footsteps of the holy apostles Peter and Paul, this sacred synod ardently implores the Christian faithful to maintain good fellowship among the nations, and if possible, to live for their part in peace with all people so that they may truly be children of God. Seeing other humans as subjects of their own history, acknowledging our propensity for cruelty and violence, and recovering our radical equality as children of God are some of the major lessons of the 20th century. The world's joys and sorrows are only met when, in the words of Pope Francisco, we dare to go out into the peripheries. Because everything is conditioned by our context. I want you to spend just a couple of minutes now with your dialogue partner. Try to identify what might be the peripheries to each of you and your own context. What are some of the places, groups, issues, problems that you can identify as being on the peripheries of your life? So if you imagine your world as a map, what or who is beyond the edges of your normal map? Okay? We're going to take about 3 minutes. Okay, so let's get some more peripheries up into our consciousness. So let me call you back and let's take a couple minutes to share some of the peripheries that came up in our partnerships here on Dialogue. So what peripheries did you guys see as you tried this exercise? Peripheries. What's outside of your maps?
Vladimir Putin.
Sorry, I didn't hear.
Putin. That's what she said. Vladimir Putin.
Vladimir Putin. Okay.
This map just has Russia over everything.
I think we took kind of what's outside of our maps and really poverty. Even when we're squeaking by or when we feel like we're squeaking by, it's nothing compared to the desolation that real poverty feels like. And even that's even talking about poverty in this country, which is very different than poverty outside the country's borders. So,
yes.
Homelessness.
Yes, right. The houseless populations that are just, especially right now with summer and heat, so much danger. Yes.
As a teacher, I taught many children whose lives were affected by drug addiction in parents. Many of them were being raised by grandparents, and Living a life of addiction, of being so enslaved to that, but yet still loving your children is totally outside of my experience. And yet I saw many kids that I saw affected by that.
Yes, thank you. Yes.
The 1%, either power or money, whatever one it is you have and you wield, that is so outside of my map to think that I should own or earn $500,000 a day. And that, what could that do for other people? That is so outside my map.
Some of the stock options, though.
But you know, that does pose a challenge, right? Like for those of us like me that sit on boards, national boards of NGOs, how do we relate to these people whose experiences are just so extraordinarily foreign to me? And how do they see my periphery, and how do I then bring them from their periphery into our space, right? So it's great. Yes.
The elders. Because, you know, sometimes, not just in the poor population, but even in the wealthy population, sometimes they are put in nursing homes and they are forgotten. So because they are taking care, then their family, those things, you know, the presence of a family always is important in the life of the elders. And sometimes poor, sometimes they don't have the money to support them, and they live lonely. Yesterday, a friend of mine, really good friend of mine, Puerto Rico, she was found dead in her house because she didn't have anybody to take care of her. And it's hard when you see that in the elders, but not just in the poor population, but also in the wealthy, when they just put them outside and then forget, and they put money to take care of them, but then the person, the human, compassion and the accompaniment is lost.
Yeah, and that's one of the groups that Pope Francisco is calling attention to a lot. It's the elderly and children. He's like, we're leaving them out of so much and not thinking about them. So thank you for bringing that up. So what an amazing list, right, that you came up with. So now remember that I said, right, that these two moments were Vatican II and today. So what's so special about today? Right? So the Catholic Church is presently involved in the largest global consultative process ever seen in human history. And although the name is a little unfortunate, the Synod on Synodality, we can unpack it a little bit, right? And if we translate it into a more human-friendly language, we could call it walking together as a global church to figure out how we can walk together better in the world. And Pope Francisco initiated this process in 2021, and it will conclude in 2024, and it's the global embodiment of accompanying la realidad, and as Pope Francis had called us into walking this path by highlighting some really very important ways of being church. And I'm going to quote some of what he has said. First, he calls us to become experts in the art of encounter. And in this, he stresses the need for time to encounter God and each other. And so he tells us that we need time to look others in the eye and listen to what they have to say, to build rapport, to be sensitive to the questions of our sisters and brothers, to let ourselves be enriched by the variety of charisms, vocations, and ministries. Every encounter, as we know, calls for openness, courage, and a willingness to let ourselves be challenged by the presence and the stories of others. Everything changes once we are capable of genuine encounters with God and with one another, without formalism or pretense, but simply as we are. Second, Pope Francisco calls us to listen, pointing out that we need to open our hearts to the world around us. And he asks, do we allow people to express themselves, to walk in faith, even though they have had difficulties in life, and to be part of the life of the community without being hindered, rejected, or judged? The Spirit asks us to listen to the questions, concerns, and hopes of every church, people, and nation, and to listen to the world, to the challenges and changes that it sets before us. Let us not soundproof our hearts. Let us not remain barricaded in our certainties. So often our certainties can make us closed. Let us listen to one another. So accompanying la realidad is something we do together because we need to learn from the perspective of what is real that others can provide for us, and which in turn increases and multiplies our insights. So third, he calls us to discernment. And he tells us that encounter and listening are not ends in themselves, leaving everything just as it was before. On the contrary, whenever we enter into dialogue, we allow ourselves to be challenged, to advance on a journey. And in the end, we're no longer the same. We're changed. So hopefully we heard the power of the Spirit pointing our hearts to where we need to be walking and what we need to be seeing in la realidad. So to get us ready for our work tomorrow, I thought we should look at some examples of walking with the world. And these are three religious congregations who have discerned in their own communities where we need to be looking if we want to truthfully accompany la realidad in a way that will help us do as Jesus and his friends did. So the university where I teach is really unique among Jesuit universities in that after being a men's only university for 60 years, we reinvented ourselves precisely by walking with la realidad. In the early 1970s, as women's movements were sprouting around the world, the university became co-ed and intentionally co-led. So our founding congregations are now three, and one of our mission pillars is the service of faith and the promotion of justice. And this banner is so old that it's been hanging in the student center since I was an undergraduate. So as they take the pulse of la realidad, where do these congregations and all the institutions they lead see the most urgent priorities? So the Jesuits have identified four universal apostolic preferences. And when they say universal, they mean global. Everywhere on the planet where Jesuit institutions and communities are present, this is where they need to be accompanying, showing the way to God. And this is actually the steps we've been taking to discern how and every day that our commitment to the world is actually rooted in God's love for the world. And the other three are extremely clear. Walking with the excluded, journeying with youth, caring for the common home. And all are about active accompaniment, walking with, journeying with, caring for. Now, the religious of the Sacred Heart of Mary are more specific in identifying who and what are their priorities. Education, social and legal services, which for the sisters is centered on walking with immigrants and those who are being trafficked, pastoral care, and working for justice. And finally, the Sisters of St. Joseph of Orange, who make it their business to embed themselves deeply within the life of communities, have a really comprehensive list of what they call their congregational stances. And it's a very specific and impressive list. And of course, all of these are on their websites. So as you head off to your day today, I'm hoping that you will have heard a call that arises out of la realidad, marking out a path of where and with whom you should be walking. Jesus was very specific, wasn't he? He said, I'm going to go accompany the poor, the imprisoned, the sick, and all who are oppressed. His walking with meant he was also going to do something about it. So how do we take the richness of this Catholic Christian tradition and have it guide us into action as these religious congregations have done, following Jesus' example? That's what we're gonna take up tomorrow. There we go.